Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and we've been bringing you voices from the NAACP Centennial Conference here in New York all this week. We will have special coverage of President Obama's address to the conference beginning at 7 o'clock tonight. And all week we've been talking about the future of the NAACP as well as the past. Their membership is getting older. Younger people don't consider the organization as relevant as they did a generation ago. When our producer, Jody Evergan, was out at the convention yesterday, he asked Raphael Vines, chairman of the NAACP Virginia Conference, about this question of relevance and the NAACP. And what about a young person who doesn't consider it relevant today?
He won't realize that the NAACP is relevant until he stopped because he's driving while black and he hadn't done anything. See, you shouldn't stop me because I'm driving while I'm black. But that happens. That's that police profiling. So when you are stopped and you are treated rough, then they turn to the NAACP. He'll forget that, you know, it's a National Colored Association. He'll need some help at that time.
So that's Raphael Vines, chairman of the NAACP Virginia Conference. But is that enough anymore? Do they need to adapt in some way, become less Martin Luther King and more Malcolm X or something? Joining me now to talk about the history and future of black empowerment movements and where the NAACP fits in is Peniel Joseph, Associate Professor of African American Studies and History at Brandeis University. He's also a contributor to the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer. Maybe you see him there. He was on with us at the political conventions last summer, and he's the author of the forthcoming book, From Black Power to Barack Obama. Professor Joseph, welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks for having me, Brian.
So is it right to view the NAACP as historically providing counterpoint to more militant black power movements, that sort of Martin versus Malcolm metaphor that I made?
Well, I think it's a little more complicated in the sense that we have to always remember there's been a national NAACP over the past century, and there's also been a local character to the NAACP. And I think at the national level, that's true. People like Roy Wilkins and different executive directors of the NAACP have had a moderate face, at least since the post-war era, when it comes to American race relations. But at the local level, you often found NAACP leaders who were quite militant and at times bucked the trend of moderation that national leadership fought for. So when people talk about relevancy for the NAACP, I think it's not necessarily a top-down issue. It's really, can the NAACP be relevant at the local level? And if it is relevant at the local level, we'll see that coalescing at a national level among the black community as well.
Can you give me a great example of that edge at the local level and maybe a recent example?
Well, I think we saw it with the Gina Six case, where at least in Louisiana we saw the NAACP and different black organizations at the local level really take that issue on. And it's probably, when we think about Ben Jealous becoming the new chairman, I think that was intended to provide sort of a corresponding edge at the national level. National leadership, he's only 35, 36 years old when he took over, somebody who understands the new generation of African Americans who are coming up. But certainly in terms of issues of police brutality at the local level, different NAACP chapters from New York to the South have been much more robust in their stance against police brutality when we look at the in recent years.
Tell us how they responded to Gina, and maybe for some people who weren't familiar with it or forgot it, what was the incident exactly?
Well, the Gina Six was an incident in Gina, Louisiana, where African-American students were involved in a fight with a white student, and basically what eventually happened was African-American students were expelled and up for long prison sentences, and basically there was a miscarriage of justice there in terms of race. So what we saw both the local NAACP but other organizers do was really cast a strobe light on that, and eventually we saw national civil rights leaders like Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton come to Gina, Louisiana. And eventually there's been I believe justice meted out in that case.
And as I recall, there was some criticism within the black community of then-candidate Barack Obama for not going to Gina or being more outspoken about it.
Certainly. Jesse Jackson did call out then-Senator Obama, saying basically that he felt that the senator should have come down to Gina and marched with civil rights leaders.
Has the black power movement, as you write about it in your books, passed on its legacy to any current empowerment figures?
Well, it really depends on how you define empowerment. I'd say yes, locally. When we think about the national level, it really just depends. Even somebody like Jesse Jackson in the 1970s straddled both fences, but certainly now would be considered more of a civil rights movement leader. But when we think about the Million Man March and aspects of the Nation of Islam and Louis Farrakhan, at least when they're talking about the politics of self-determination, we see some of that animating from the Black Power era. But when we think about Black Power politics per se, probably at the local level we're seeing it more. One of the interesting things that happened to then-candidate Obama in August of 2008 was certain Black Power activists in St. Petersburg, Florida, actually heckled the president, who was then senator, with a big sign that said, "What about the black community, Obama?" And what was very interesting is these activists in St. Petersburg, Florida, were actually connected to activists who had been in the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee and activists who in the 1960s had been black power militants. And so in 2008, even though on one level they were proud that Obama was running, they still wanted a more racially specific agenda to a policy agenda to his campaign.
Listeners, we can take your phone calls for Peniel Joseph, historian at Brandeis, author of the forthcoming book, From Black Power to Barack Obama. Anything on the NAACP, past, present, or future, on this occasion of its centennial being celebrated here in New York? And we'll get into a little bit of the history as to why that organization was born here and not in the South. But anyone listening who's attended any of this convention this week, call us up. What's been good or bad or indifferent that you've heard from the podium? We've had Colin Powell speaking. We'll play a clip of him in a little while, and lots of other people. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Did you hear the Attorney General speak, Eric Holder? It's funny, Professor Joseph, we really have Bronx justice in the Obama administration. His Attorney General appointment and now his Supreme Court nomination, both from the Bronx.
Yeah, now that's in contrast to so many Harvard appointments from Cambridge, Massachusetts. So it's good to see New York have some access in the administration, definitely.
But our phone number, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, or post to WNYC.org, click on Brian Lehr Show. How much do you know about the history of the NAACP being born in New York?
Well, certainly, it's really coming out of the Second National Negro Conference in 1910, where people like W.E.B. Du Bois and different reformers, really at times predominantly white reformers, although people like Ida B. Wells are part of the ferment of the time, even though she's not going to be on the final list of 40 who are going to be permanent on the organization. So New York is a huge part of the NAACP because being configured because W.E.B. Du Bois was in Atlanta at the time, based in Atlanta, teaching at Atlanta University, and couldn't teach in northern-based universities because of racial segregation. But New York becomes a hotbed of interracial reform during the Progressive Era. So people like Mary Ovington and W.E.B. Du Bois are going to be critical to the formation of the NAACP. So that's basically by the spring of 1910 is the conference that the NAACP comes out of, and by the next year it's going to have its formal constitution.
Terrence in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Terrence.
How you doing, Brian?
Okay.
I was listening, and I was very intrigued by your discussion here with your guest. I'm sorry, I forgot his name.
Peniel Joseph, historian.
How you doing, Mr. Joseph?
Oh, very good. Thank you.
In regards to giving examples of folks that the NAACP has sort of pressed aside or exiled. You got Robert F. Williams, who was probably one of the most radical of the NAACP chapters in the South, in North Carolina.
When was that? What era?
During the 50s and 60s.
Well, yes, it's going to be mid-1950s in Monroe, North Carolina. And, by 1961, Robert Williams is in Cuba.
And what did he do? Why was he so controversial?
Well, Williams advocated armed self-reliance, basically armed self-defense against white terrorists in Monroe, North Carolina, and he's going to be censored
That's
by
right.
the NAACP in 1959.
That's right. And the reason why I think that the NAACP has become less relevant to young people nowadays is twofold. Number one, young people lack a fundamental education about their culture, especially young black people. They're not taught about people like Robert F. Williams. They're only taught about the general ideals of the NAACP, if they're taught at all.
So what? Tell us, Terrence, why you pick out the Williams story. Looking back,
well,
even today,
he's the most prominent of the individuals that would have been considered radical.
Is it that you think that there was value in young black people arming themselves en masse, or is it something else?
I think there's a value, not really in necessarily saying because they armed themselves, but because they were willing to stand in circumstances where other members of that organization were considered mild or passive.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people need the balance between the two in order to understand the value of the whole.
Terrence, thank you very much. You want to say anything else about that, Professor Joseph?
Well, I'd say that the local character of the NAACP is going to be usually at variance with the national character in this sense. The NAACP is never really a mass membership organization. I mean, the closest it's going to come is in the 1940s when there's about a half a million members. I don't know what the membership is now currently. But when we think about the local character, and whether it's Robert F. Williams in the 1950s in Monroe, North Carolina, or, I mean, I recently spoke in New Bedford, Massachusetts, local NAACP there, and they have a vibrant local NAACP chapter in Massachusetts, in New Bedford, that's quite progressive politically. So we always have to understand that there's a national character, and so you can have Ben Jealous saying, okay, here's what the national NAACP is about, and here's our convention, and then we the real character and shape and texture of the organization is going to take place at the neighborhood level. So it really depends on how does the local NAACP attract African-Americans at that grassroots community-based level by articulating issues and themes that really appeal to whatever local problems and character that's there.
Tanya in Newark, you're on WNYC. Hi, Tanya.
Hi, good morning. How are you?
Good, thank you.
Good. I had the opportunity to attend a lecture series last evening with Julian Bond and Cornel West at the Barnes & Noble in Union Square. Julian Bond made a statement regarding NAACP. He stated that the colored people or people of any color. Now, my concern is that traditionally and historically, it was for African-American people. So where do we stand now with the organization? Is it now supporting African-American people or anyone at large? Because, again, traditionally, it was for the rights and responsibilities of black people.
It's a great question, Tanya. And, Professor Joseph, I've actually seen that in some of their literature this week around the centennial, saying this is not just an organization for black civil rights. This is a broad civil rights organization for all women, all people of color, et cetera, in the United States.
Well, yeah, I think it's always been that, and they might be trying to emphasize that as we get into a 21st century multicultural movement. That being said, I think its predominant membership has been African American, along with white allies at times, Latino allies, certainly women. Whether or not it's going to continue to be dominated by African Americans in the future, that remains to be seen. But I think it's always been a broad-based organization, even though it's primarily been dominated, at least in the post-war era, by more African Americans.
Tanya, does it bother you to think that its agenda might be that broad?
It does. does bother me because, as I stated, traditionally it is for the advancement of colored persons. The black people, the only colored people whom I know of. It does bother me because I don't see the NAACP at the forefront of quite many African American issues, and that's a major concern. This is why I've never become a member, because I don't see them out in the forefront trying to resolve and stomp out the bigotry and the racism that we're still faced with.
But you didn't just say that black people are the only people of color you know of, did you?
Well initially, colored people are whom? Traditionally and historically, colored people were African American people. Again, that is the backbone of why it was established for black people, correct?
Professor Joseph?
Well, I'd say historically, when people talked about colored people, she is correct. People were really referring to Negro. Negro and colored were pretty much interchangeable. Now, though, I would say that when people talk about people of color, they're talking about a wide range of racial minorities, whether it's African Americans or Latino Americans or Asian Americans or people who are from India or Pakistan or what have you. So I'd say that the NAACP, if the literature this week is really trying to expansively redefine colored, that's where they're going. But certainly at the founding meeting in 1910, when they're saying advancement, National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, colored in that sense was interchangeable with Negro.
Tanya, thank you very much for your call. So what does that mean in terms of issues? Do you think they'll shift their primary focus to economic justice in a broad-based way, or to immigration issues, which is actually a divisive issue in the black community, because many African Americans feel that jobs, especially those who are taking lower-end jobs or competing for them, are competing with illegal immigrants? So can it be all of those things to all of those people?
Well, I think it's trying to thread the needle in that sense. I mean, you talked earlier about, you alluded to Justice Sotomayor, and one of the reasons why Justice Sotomayor, I think, will be confirmed as a Supreme Court justice is because many of the senators who have to vote for her face constituencies where one out of three of their voters or even more are Latino and Latina. So when we think about the NAACP, if the NAACP can find areas of solidarity and common ground with other people and other groups of color, especially those who are Spanish speakers, it would add tremendously to that organization's power as a lobbying group. And if along the same road, they could actually really foster understanding among African Americans and Latinos on a whole host of issues, including immigration, that would make that block potentially a very strong block. Because if we look at the United States and say, well, by 2050, it's going to be a majority-minority country, if African-American voters and Latino voters had more in common than they did differences, that could be a very, very strong voting block at the local and national level.
Brandeis historian Peniel Joseph, my guest for another few minutes here on WNYC, and Pancho in Plainfield, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Hi. my concern and focus is what are you doing in this time and age to address issues and cases that can affect the broader community? For instance, if a state government is acting in a way that's the bottom line is to deny justice and equal treatment under the law to particularly African Americans, because that's who I am.
Are you thinking of a certain case, Pancho?
I'm thinking of what I'm dealing with right now and the conduct that I am faced with now, and trying to get some assistance just to address, just to approach redress of grievance is just unthinkable.
So, Professor Joseph, does the NAACP, and of course We don't know the real particulars of Pancho's case, whatever it is. But is the NAACP an organization today? Was it ever? And is it today an organization that he can go to with a particular case of feeling wrong by the state?
Oh, absolutely. I think the NAACP's Legal Defense Fund historically and in present day as well has made its bread and butter off of contesting cases of racial discrimination at the local and the state and the federal level. I would say that depending on whatever presidential and federal administration is in there, the NAACP's grievances and cases that they're filing on behalf of people who feel they're victims of racial discrimination, it's going to be really the receptiveness of that is going to be based on the administration. So presumably in an Obama administration with Eric Holder leading the Justice Department, many of the kind of lawsuits and discriminatory cases that the NAACP are filing will have a much more receptive hearing than under the previous administration.
And I want to take one more call because you talked about the importance of local NAACP chapters in getting stuff done and leading the national. And Jackie in Norwalk wants to give a shout-out to their local chapter, which she says has been very active. Jackie, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi. How are you?
Okay.
The Norwalk branch of the NAACP, it's a small branch, but it has been extremely active in a number of fields. For example, we brought suit against the city of Norwalk on a question of fair housing, which instituted a fair housing officer and fair housing office. We monitored court proceedings recently and saw to it that a couple of prejudiced judges and badly behaving marshals are no longer doing what they were doing, and there's more courteous treatment of people there. We have a legal redress committee where people can file complaints. You know, they get them from our website and are in touch with our legal redress committee. We're extremely active in education. We're very concerned with the achievement gap between both African American and Hispanic or Latino children and white children. We're really out there, and I was interested in Professor Joseph's mention that the local branches are in some ways more militant than the national organization, but I don't think that's true. We've gotten some excellent leadership now, and I think with Ben Jealous there, I think we're going to be pulling together much more.
All right, Jackie, thank you very much, and we're going to give Jackie the last word in this segment today. Listeners, we're continuing to collect your thoughts and stories about the NAACP past, present, and its relevance for the future on our webpage, WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. Of course, we will have live coverage of President Obama's speech to the NAACP centennial here at the New York Hilton tonight. Our special coverage begins at 7. And again, we want to thank Peniel Joseph, Associate Professor of African American Studies and History at Brandeis University, his forthcoming book, From Black Power to Barack Obama. Professor Joseph, thanks always for being with us.
Thanks for having us.
And we're going to come back to an NAACP issue coming up a little bit later this hour and talk to a top recruiter for the U.S. Army who's attending the convention. We will ask whether the economic draft leaves too many black Americans in harm's way. But first, we'll check in on the latest crazy goings on in Albany and put some of you on the air on the question we've been asking all morning. What role should parents play under the law in public schools? Stay tuned.